You are listening to station WGN.
Oh, a microphone.
And a phony at the mic.
Yes. Whoa!
And radio became an accepted vehicle for nationwide news and opinion.
Notify all radio and TV stations to broadcast the following message.
Oh, is that the comedy spot?
No, Bubblehead, this isn't a comedy spot.
You're a fun guy, Dave. You're lonely on an island.
What a dope. What a maroon.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is exciting, isn't it?
10, 5, 4, 3, 2...
Well, hello there, everybody. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Very happy you can join us on this Saturday night, early Sunday morning. If you're napping right now, I'll talk a little quieter. Tonight, we're talking about the 90th anniversary of the invention of television and the 10 shows that changed the TV landscape. And joining us this morning also is my pal, Wally Podrazik. He's the author of a tremendous book called Watching TV, adjunct lecturer at Northwestern University, curator at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. He's got a lot of business cards, I'm telling you, this guy.
My goodness.
He's fabulous. Good morning, Wally.
Good morning.
What's happening, buddy?
It's actually University of Illinois at Chicago.
Is
UIC,
it?
Not Northwestern.
Why did I say Northwestern?
I went to Northwestern. I graduated
from
Northwestern.
Oh, that's what it was. There you go. It's UIC, of course.
Well, then that can still go on the business card.
But let's first talk about watching TV, because what edition is this now?
This is the third edition.
Yeah.
It's now 8 decades of American television.
Yeah.
Going from the beginning, in fact, before the beginning.
Yeah.
Until
heavy.
First time the latest edition came in, I said to myself, it's like a Sears catalog back in the day.
This is so cool. I love this book.
But the thing that I'm very proud of for Watching TV, you want to get more information about it, you just go to watchingtv.org. And if you want to read my musings in the present, go to mediawally.com. And what it is it tells the story of television season by season. So it's chronological.
With grids.
With grids.
Which is kind of cool, yeah.
And timelines and all. But the thing I'm particularly proud of is that it is self-contained tales of each season, which means that if you want to know what it was like in the mid-60s or in the mid-80s, just flip right there,
yeah.
and you don't have to start on page one. You can start on page 201, read that chapter, and just skip around, and you'll get a satisfying story no matter where you are in the tale. Or you can start on page one, and I'll see you at the end of 500 and some odd pages.
It's kind of what I do is I grab the book, I just kind of page it through a little, and then I pick a spot and learn something new.
Well,
I love it. It's
a lot of
fun.
That's the purpose.
It is a purpose. Even though television began to come of age in the late 1940s, it was September 7th, 1927, that an American inventor transmitted an image through an electronic means. It was called a image dissector. But this was the first all-electronic television that came about.
And that was really important because that changed it from the way television will work is like the movies where you have this thing imprinted and that you see these images flashing and then your eye plays tricks and all. Your eye still does play tricks, but you didn't need all of the mechanics, all of the incredibly hot light, all of the stuff that really was keeping television from expanding to what it would eventually become. And so this young farm boy, out in the field, saw the field rose and said, you know, that's how it'll work. Now, it wasn't just that he happened to see that
that's
there are waves that would work, because he also had the wherewithal to execute the idea.
Yeah.
But the fact is, you had a 14-year-old kid who did what all the other folks around the world, because this was a worldwide search of trying to make electronic television work, and he figured out how to do it.
It's amazing.
And so that one of the
amazingly how he was inspired to do it too.
It was inspiring, and it was little guy versus everybody else.
Sure.
And so we're going to be marking that.
Philo T. Farnsworth.
Philo T. Farnsworth is the young man, was the young man's name. And Wednesday, September 6th, at the Museum of Broadcast Communication, I'm going to be spearheading a discussion about that. And we have a gentleman from a couple of years ago.
Is Philo going to be there?
Philo is not. But
smarty pants.
But there's a gentleman out on the West Coast in San Francisco who's rented the lab or the building, the space that had been used by Philo, and he's going to be joining us for a little bit of that discussion.
That's cool. And there was a documentary also on PBS where his sisters were interviewed.
And he's been in very, very close contact with the family and all. So
that's
he'll
cool.
have some recent stories there. And from the Chicago side, Timeline Theater Company put on the Aaron Sorkin-authored Farnsworth invention about 5 years ago. So we're having one of the
At the Broadcast Museum. So there's these Wednesday nights that happen at the Broadcast Museum.
Roughly once a month, sometimes twice a month.
Yeah, and for more on that, of course, you can visit museum.tv. So during the first 10, 20 years, sports, plays, operas, there was not a lot of regular programming.
No, there wasn't,
so to speak,
because you had things like, the Great Depression, World War II.
Well, not everybody had televisions, obviously. Very few people had radios.
And it was actually to try to get that penetration similar to radio that people said, let's put programs on that will motivate people to shell out the big bucks, comparatively at that time, it was big bucks to have a television in your own home.
Sure.
What you started out doing was going to the corner tavern and watching the fights.
Sure.
Or watching broad slapstick. This is in the late 40s, like Milton Berle.
Yeah, my grandfather said he used to go to the tavern and watch Jack Brickhouse call the fights.
Exactly, why would you need that thing in your house when it was a social occasion as much as anything else?
So tonight was the big fight that was on, right? Who won again, Roger?
Who won?
Mayweather.
Okay,
10th round TKO.
But here's another thing. So here's a place where you can't watch it anywhere unless you're going to a place, obviously, that's offering it. They're offering a cover charge. It's very old school how this went tonight.
Very old school.
So my son said, I'm going over to a buddy's house, and it's going to be 10 of us, and we're all splitting. We're all throwing in 10 bucks so we can pay for the fight tonight. So very old school getting together as a group and finding a place to watch something unique, but that was really the early days of television.
Well, and actually, flip ahead, even the early days of cable and special pay-per-view. In other words, it's like, I can't afford it, but a bunch of us can, so let's go together and experience this. And when I teach history of TV at UIC, that's one of the things I point out is that, yes, there's always somebody doing something new, which probably echoes what was done 10, 20, 50, 70 years ago.
Absolutely. In 1941, I was looking at this first commercial, which is Bulova Watches, during a Dodgers and a Phillies game. I remember Betty White telling me that she was on in the World's Fair in New York, I think in the late 1930s. And
that would be it,
she was in an experimental TV broadcast, talk about the latest Oldsmobile or whatever it was.
And by the way, the subtitle of Watching TV is 8 Decades of American Television. Betty White's in every decade.
Oh, yeah.
I love her for that.
Yeah, right. I mean, I know she's going to be 96. I know, she's slowing down a little bit. I haven't seen much of her lately.
Wasn't that broadcast in the World's Fair? That was the NBC experimental broadcast. That was a huge event at the time.
Sure.
The head of NBC leading the ceremonies. Yeah, Sarnoff led the ceremonies. That was his big get, was that he was now going to make the jump from radio to television and own everything. You tried to in radio.
Which you did, absolutely. Yeah. 47 was the big year. Howdy Doody, Kraft Television Theater, Meet the Press, the World Series broadcast live for the first time. 48 was Ed Sullivan, Texaco Star Theater.
Jerry Lewis, the first Ed Sullivan.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. 49, the first Emmy Awards are given. But 90 years since the invention, 70 years since the television we know today came to fruition. Let's talk about the 10 shows that truly, we'll say 10 plus.
More or less.
Yeah, that truly changed television. Of course, the first one you note is I Love Lucy.
And it has to be I Love Lucy for a couple of reasons. One is that it showed what would work on television, which was the Hollywood screwball comedy. It was a young couple, people post-war could identify with the young couple trying to make it in the world. And put aside all of the entertainment value of I Love Lucy and look at the business side, where it was the beginning of Desilu Studios. It was a filmed series. It was not live. And it showed, here's how you make the real money on television, syndicated reruns.
Which CBS had no interest in doing and could not did not have the foresight to figure that out.
No, because it's, all right, I'll take a pay cut. Or, you know, Lucy and Desi will take a pay cut. But we'll cover the production costs and we'll own the series.
People might say Texaco Star Theater with Milton Berle, because he sold so many televisions. He was really the first large figure on television. But it didn't really establish the format for what television became to be. It was more of a vaudevillian show.
It was vaudeville. And the thing to remember is that, that when Milton Berle was out there, the whole country was not tuned in as one. Yeah. Because the way Lucy came after they had established coast-to-coast coaxial cable, meaning everyone could watch it.
Everybody could see it. That's right. So, that's right. Dragnet.
Dragnet, then, basically police procedural.
Yeah.
And
Perry Mason, too. Yeah.
And if you combine Dragnet and a little later in the decade, Perry Mason, you've got the two cornerstones of crime shows. And later we'll see, like, Law and Order with Dick Wolf say, good idea. Let's put them both together.
Yeah, he did. That's exactly what he did.
But basically, that's what you're doing.
Yeah. The Honeymooners.
We got to talk about The Honeymooners in the sense of that, if anything could capture what it was like in that part of the 20th century in regular workaday world, that would be The Honeymooners.
Yeah.
I mean,
the working class man.
Working class man. I'll tell you, that was the only TV series that I looked and said, oh, I recognize that from my neighborhood.
Yeah.
The Beaver Cleaver lived in a gorgeous house. That's not where I lived.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
It would be, and of course, the relationship between husband and wife, Jackie Gleason, and Alice, one of these days.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was the type of thing that just crackled with energy.
But you're right, it was years, it was really over a decade later, then you saw that same thing again in All in the Family.
Oh, sure. And in fact, when people were looking back, say, oh, Archie is like Ralph.
Yeah.
And in some ways, Archie learned more than Ralph. Ralph never learned his lesson, whereas over time, I know Norman Lear always points about how the character of Archie Bunker was sort of the epitome of his dad and his memories and the way you'd be so stubborn and all. And over the course of the series, Archie learned. Archie grew.
Yeah.
And you could see him growing. And that was probably why it lasted as long as it did.
But you note a few things. The first toilet flush on television, the death of a spouse.
Right.
But Norman Lear's shows were as close to real as you could get.
In the same way that The Honeymooners was real for its era, All in the Family was saying, hey, you know what, on television, let's show what people really are experiencing in everyday life.
So after three, we're going to talk to Joyce Randolph, who's the only living member of the cast of The Honeymooners. And then we're going to look back at my conversation with Norman Lear. I think we're doing that at 3:30. Andy Griffith, Rural Humor, Beverly Hillbillies, Gomer Pyle. It was that golden era of the top shows that CBS eventually said, yeah, we're not going to do that anymore.
Right, because we want to redefine our demographics.
Yeah,
and there's
a
famous quote where I think someone like Red Skelton was talking to Jackie Gleason and he said, what's a demographic? You know, like, what is this? We get great audiences, but it's not good enough anymore?
Right. Dick Van Dyke, first of all, a legend, and we're going to be talking, looking back at that interview at 2:30. I still think in all of television, when I look back at any sitcom, although I love The Honeymooners and I Love Lucy, I think Dick Van Dyke holds up the best.
And Dick Van Dyke basically has a rich history going both directions. You have the creator, Carl Reiner, saying, let me write what I know. Your show of shows, let's do my life, except get the talented Dick Van Dyke to play me.
Yeah.
Handsomer me, and more talented.
He tried to play it. He tried to play himself.
He tried to play and didn't quite work, but Dick Van Dyke pulled it off. And then flip it, and basically Dick Van Dyke is basically the template for the whole MTM enterprises, Mary Tyler Moore, and everything that came out of there. Because it had that sensibility of incredibly good writing, incredibly good acting, and awareness of its own past. And taking viewers seriously, treating them with as sophisticated consumers of art.
And Dick Van Dyke again after 2:30, we talked to Rose Marie. I don't know if you knew this a few weeks back.
I did too earlier this year.
Holy smokes. She's 94 and honestly the best storyteller. And they're doing a movie on her life that should be coming out soon. I know they just had like a kind of a preview event, but people don't know that she was the first child star long before Shirley Temple.
Yeah, and I guess it would be like child star all the way through till now. It's just amazing.
Your show shows, you mentioned, of course, that kind of refined what SNL has become. 60 Minutes, of course, Star Trek, you know, launching a 60-year-old brand on Star Trek. The Fugitive, absolutely, it's one of those shows that I will watch randomly throughout the week. At any point, it is so good.
Two lines on The Fugitive. One, it totally redefined how one looked at television with its concluding two episodes. In other words, you've been following these characters up until that point. Producers said, oh, well, okay, we stopped making it. And here it said, no, we're going to resolve the story. And they did. And you enjoyed following the story up until that point. So it worked on two levels.
You mentioned the Aaron Spelling shows, Mod Squad, Love Boat, Dynasty, of course.
Formula.
At All in the Family, we talked about Happy Days. Mainstream, retro, family humor. It was the number one show on television.
Yeah, I mean, basically you had the Norman Lear circle, you had the MTM circle, and then you had the Gary Marshall circle. And that basically defined television for decades.
It did. Hill Street Blues, really different type of cop show that came around in the early 1980s.
And it was a procedural, but it was a procedural that felt even grittier. You know, handheld camera and had random plot threads just going all over the place.
Sopranos, I'm with you on that one. I would still say I would put The Sopranos, Hill Street Blues, The Fugitive all up there. And then I could still watch at any point.
In terms of defining drama, the Sopranos it pulled that incredible trick of having you cheer for a ruthless killer.
Yeah.
And you say, well, everything he's doing is wrong.
Yeah.
But I want him to get away with it because I like him. It's Tony.
Sure, it is Tony. I think one of the best dramas. And a lot of lists say it's the best drama on television. The Simpsons, of course, preceded by The Flintstones is the first.
Oh, sure. But animated. The Simpsons managed to, well, it's now the longest running.
It's crazy.
Forget your category.
Yeah.
Of all scripted TV series, animated series, comedy series, what have you.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer, of course. And then you talk about Walking Dead, Breaking Bad, and Mad Men, all being these really unique cable shows that have been groundbreaking all throughout.
If you want to see what did the Sopranos begat, and it would be them especially something like Breaking Bad, where you say I'm cheering for a reprehensible person, and yet I want him to win.
You also mentioned Seinfeld.
We were sitting in the green room.
We gotta put them in there because I mean it is one of those shows again. There's very few sitcoms that you can really just jump into at any moment, and that's one of them.
Yeah. After you've enjoyed your Dick Van Dyke, across the street, and
you're so right.
Go to Seinfeld.
I would even say there's some little boutique shows that I love, like the Arrested Developments and so forth over the years that I would say.
Oh, and everyone has those. That's the beauty of television is that we personally identify with our own favorites.
And then, of course, the evolution of broadcasting into Netflix and Amazon and so forth. And you would put House of Cards right up there.
Yeah, House of Cards, and that's more for what it did. Namely, Netflix comes along, we say, we know what kind of movies people rent, we know what kind of movies people stick with, and we know what performers they like.
Yeah.
And Kevin Spacey is someone they like, so let's go with him with this series, and it worked.
But the binging part of this whole thing,
goodness,
where you can watch, I mean, that really came, you know, a lot of the cable networks have done 6-hour blocks of shows over time. The Golden Girls, you can see Frasier, some of these that they do all the time. But this is different. It's a different type of experience because you're offered every episode in front of you, and it's up to you based on your interest. Are you going to watch all 10 episodes? Are you going to break them up throughout the week? Sometimes you can't. It's like eating chocolate. You got to keep watching until it's over.
I use as my personal definition, three is perfect, four is too much. You just got to step away.
I'm with that. Yeah, you're right. You need a fresh, you get a little refresher.
Or else you're just doing it to go down the checklist.
You're totally right. You're totally right. Well, we have many of these pioneers that we will share in interviews tonight. Comedy legend Dick Van Dyke, the Honeymooners' Joyce Randolph, iconic TV producer Norman Lear, and from, okay, so I threw this one in just because it was a fun conversation, is from classic 60s and 70s comedy, I Dream of Jeannie. So that was kind of like this era of Jeannie, Bewitched, the Munsters, the Addams Family, kind of out of ordinary family.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But again, that's television. It's pure escapism. And I will not watch every episode of I Dream of Jeannie, but I'll tell you, if I come across it, oh, sure, I'm going to watch that.
Yeah, of course you're going to.
Because they have such a solid cast.
Yeah,
totally true. And they have so much fun with the premise. Of course it's an absurd premise, but so what?
But I'm going to tell you, if you love television like I do, you've got to pick up this book, Watching TV. It's 8 decades of television. It is a brilliantly written book. It is so much fun to read. Again, really telling about the stories of each era of television, the shows, the grids, how the network scheduled their shows. It's a fabulous book, and where can they get them, buddy?
Easiest thing is just go online. Go to Amazon, whatever your favorite online purveyor is. Go to watchingtv.org to read about watching TV, and go to mediawally.com to see any of my musings of pop culture in general.
And then Wednesday the 6th at the Museum of Broadcast Communications,
live streaming.
A live streaming that you can check out at museum.tv. Sounds good, buddy. Thank you, as always.
Thank you.
All right. Dick Van Dyke, Joyce Randolph, Norman Lear, Barbara Eden, all coming up next. 720 WGN.
No, Rob. At the very end of the show, I didn't handle myself too well with that Patrick rat.
He got you to say something embarrassing, didn't he? What was it?
That Alan Brady is bald.
You... You say he had no hair on television, honey. Oh, sweetheart, you knew that was a secret, didn't you?
Yeah,
that's right. What's the fun in telling if it's not a secret?
But Rob, he tricked me.
Oh, he tricked you. All right, he tricked you. Oh, he's very, very tricky. But telling the whole world about Alan's wig, oh, are we in trouble?
No, Rob, you saw the way he asked those questions. I mean, you just hardly know how to answer them. Rob, I just don't know what to do.
Answer the phone. Alan will tell you what to do. Hello? Oh, buddy. Huh? How'd you find out?
But Sal, how did she... She read it in the newspaper.
Anyway, buddy... Huh? Oh, boy. Okay, well, listen, I'll see you tomorrow. Maybe. Thanks a lot.
Well?
Well, the item in the paper said, question of whether Alan Brady is bald or not was answered today on television by the wife of the future ex-writer of the Alan Brady show.
Hey, everybody, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. For countless generations, show business legend Dick Van Dyke has been entertaining us for nearly 70 years with the Emmy Award-winning Dick Van Dyke Show, and he's living proof that life does get better the longer you live it. Dick's optimistic outlook is an invigorating tonic for anyone who needs a reminder that life should be lived with enthusiasm despite what the calendar says. And truly, he is an American icon, and Dick Van Dyke is joining us tonight. Dick, how are you, my friend?
I'm just great, Dave. Good to talk to you, Dave.
Oh, same here. You know, growing up watching television, watching the movies, your work has really, honestly, earned you the title of a true American icon. I'm so honored you're spending some time with us tonight.
Isn't that funny? It must be good genes. I don't know what else.
Okay, fair enough. Well, you know, I know you're raised right here in Danville, Illinois. Your dad worked for the Sunshine Biscuit Company. You just helped save your childhood home that was going to be demolished. How cool is that?
It was an old house when I grew up in it. It must have been built around the turn of the century. But somebody noticed it and decided it ought to be preserved, formed some kind of a group, and are raising funds to see it. I'm afraid I just had nothing to do with it, but I am. You know, when the folks you were raised with recognize it, it's a new one. Emmy's one thing, but that's more important. This. From your hometown.
Yeah, they said, you know, they got this new foundation. They want to provide scholarships to accomplish young performers in your name, and I can't think of a better way to honor you. That's a very cool thing.
You'll have to take my advice and not do what I did.
Well,
train, for God's sake.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you did, because, you know, this long, amazing life of yours and why you keep moving and continuing to have the time of your life. It's about moving and keeping things forward. You worked in radio first, which I found fascinating. It was like World War II. You were 16 years old when many of the newsmen and disc jockeys on the air were drafted. They needed to recruit new talent. And at 16 years old, you got your first job on the air.
I got the job. I loved it. I have to tell you a story. After the war, must have been 45 or so, I actually got an audition at your station. I took the train to Chicago, checked into just a flea bag hotel I could afford, and left a call. They didn't call me, and I missed the audition, and I got on the train, came home. It was going to be my big break. I was going to be at WGN, and I missed it altogether.
Oh, my.
So I became a comedian instead.
So you became a comedian. Well,
isn't that funny?
It is. It is. That's a wild story. And, you know, so you're performing on Broadway in the 60s, early 60s, Bye Bye Birdie. Sheldon Leonard and Carl Reiner saw your performance. And at that time, there was a sitcom pilot floating around written by and starring Carl called Head of the Family, which eventually became The Dick Van Dyke Show. How did that meeting and all that come about?
Actually, I don't think I even met them that night. They didn't come back. I heard, Carl sent me about 8 scripts he had written. And I had a little idea of my own, which I threw out the window. I've read some of the best writing I've ever read. I don't know why I think CBS told him, we like the show, but get a better actor.
That happens. I mean, that happens. You know, you got great ideas, but they want to bring someone else into the role. And you knew, obviously, your show shows in Sid Caesar, so you know how good the writing was going to be with Carl, right?
God, yes. For 5 years, I wouldn't leave the house on Saturday night because of your show of shows.
Sure.
You know, you couldn't tape it back then. You either saw it then or not. I would not leave the house. That was, I think, a real milestone. They changed the face of television comedy with that show.
They did, and it's funny you say that because, you know, with all the reruns that are out there, and, you know, you see the Lucys in your show and so forth, but that's in the Honeymooners, but that's one that doesn't get a lot of play, like from a syndication standpoint, and really was one of the most brilliantly written
shows. There's only 10 shows left.
Oh.
They destroyed them all.
Oh, isn't that something?
I can't, but there were 10, and the rest were all, the Kennys were destroyed. That's really tragic.
Yeah, it is tragic. It is. And no one could figure out, really, they weren't going to use Head of the Family. They really didn't know what to call the show, and nobody really knew at that point who Dick Van Dyke was. But they settled on that. But they settled on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yeah, well, we couldn't think of a name, but Double Trouble and things of that kind. Everything we thought of was pretty corny. So I think that was part of the reason we failed the first season. Nobody knew what a Dick Van Dyke was. That's what Rosemary said when they asked her about doing on the show. She said, what's a Dick Van Dyke?
That's great. That's great. Well, speaking of which, you know, Maury Amsterdam, Rosemary were already cast in the show. They weren't in the pilot, but they were cast for the new show. How great. What amazing talents to be able to work with, right?
I've never fallen into such a perfect blend of a performer. We were like an improv group.
Yeah.
God, they were good. It was such fun.
That's awesome. And I know Mary Tyler Moore was, 23 years old at the time when she was auditioning?
I was 12 years older.
Wow.
I said, God, I didn't feel a little young. But the funny thing is, on the 5 years, nobody ever said, isn't he a little old for her?
Well, and the chemistry was amazing between the two of you, but at first you weren't sure she could do comedy. I mean, that really wasn't her background, but she really did show everybody she could do it.
I know. Even she didn't know she could do comedy.
Yeah.
She was just, of course she had Rosie and Maury and Carl Reiner, a lot of people who knew what they were doing, and it just rubbed off on her.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the character of Rob Petrie, how much of Rob Petrie was Dick Van Dyke?
Well, quite a bit. Carl always said that they wrote Yiddish, and we played British. There would be, you know, what I want to say, a Jewish sense of something. Again, it's hard to put. Jewish wisdom, Jewish experience.
Mm-hmm.
It was, and then we did it American. But I played a guy who, you know, had a lot of child inside. He was intelligent and a nice guy, but he had a childlike fear of authority and not a lot of confidence in himself outside of his own, you know, bailiwick.
Yeah.
And I'd love to play in that.
Well, I will tell you, I mean, the show, though, stands on its own almost 60 years later. You know, there's not, you know, and I know you know this by watching some, there's some shows that, because of dated material and so forth, it's hard to watch today. You know it's from another era. That show, the writing, is so amazing that it completely is one of those shows that stands up today.
That was, Carl did that on purpose. He didn't want any jokes of the day, any mention of the news of the day. And even the clothes are starting to look the same again. They're coming back.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. No, it's true. It's totally true. Now, I have to tell you, when the show opens, now my kids are 14, 10, and just about 4 years old. And when the show starts, they pause it in the beginning, and they literally place bets. Is he going to trip? Is he going to skip around? Is he going to almost make it? Which is it going to be? And they all, I swear, they should be playing for money.
You know, a lot of people did. A lot of people gambled on that.
Yeah. What a fun way, though, to just get you engaged right at the front of the show.
Yeah, it really was. Of course, Carl hadn't written any physical comedy at all, but he, out of deference to my love for it, he let me do it.
And, you know, you were mentioning earlier, first season, 39 episodes, which 39 episodes in one season is, of course, unheard of today. I mean, now they're doing like 13, 9 episodes.
I know. And, you know, Carl wrote every one of them.
Oh, it's amazing. That is absolutely
amazing. He was calling for help by the second
season. I bet he was. Now, Maury, and I know this because I've seen you perform with the Fantastics, your a cappella group, which we'll talk about in a little bit. He wrote lyrics to the show that were never published.
Never published. It's so sad. So we're spreading the word now. We sing them.
I know you do. I'm going to ask you. Do you got a little bit of that for us?
Okay. So you think that you got trouble? Well, trouble's a bubble. So tell all Mr. Trouble to get lost. Why not hold your head up high and stop crying? Start trying. And don't forget to keep your fingers crossed. When you find the joy of living is loving and giving, you'll be there when the winning dice are tossed. A smile is just a frown that's turned upside down. So smile on that frown or defrost. And don't forget to keep your fingers crossed. And then I fall down.
That's fantastic.
The sweetest lyrics. And he never even mentioned it to anybody.
Dick, I know Walt Disney called you personally about the part of Bert in Mary Poppins.
He did. I thought it was because I, you know, had been singing and dancing. He had simply heard a quote of mine about the dearth of decent family entertainment. So knowing I could sing and dance, he said, well, that's the guy I want. And that day when I went in and the Sherman Brothers played that score for me, and they showed, of course, he had all the scenes in watercolor all over the walls of his office. I walked out of there on the air. My God, I just knew it was going to be a great movie.
But, I mean, it was Walt Disney himself reached out to you personally and said, come on down. And they were playing, like they were selling you almost on the part.
We became very good friends. Kind of we were on the opposite sides of the political fence, but still, he was a big kid. He was really a child inside, an old shoe of a kind of a guy. We just talked and talked and talked together.
Now, I know there was an amazing amount of singing and dancing, the Cockney accent. Did you have a lot of time to prepare at that time in the movies, or did you really just go into rehearsal and then hit it?
No, we had lots of time on the dance numbers, the rooftops, I think. They built the stage out of plywood out in the back lot. And we spent about 6 weeks on that. I spent one evening on the accent. They hired an Irishman as a coach. Pat O'Malley, who was no better than I.
To teach you the Cockney accent.
Tweet, not that last summer there was a tweet with Judi Dench and Jeremy Irons and a bunch of great British actors. They were asked, who did the worst British accent in the history of movies? I won, hands down.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So I said, I wrote him back and said, it's great to be number one.
It is great to be number one.
Yeah, they were so cute about it.
What is the hardest part about getting older, Dick? I mean, there's some things you have given up, and tennis and some other things, but I mean, you still go work out. You get up at 6 o'clock in the morning typically every day. You got a key to your own gym. They gave you a key, for God's sake, so you can get in there early and work out.
That's sometime pretty... there before the owners get
awesome.
There.
Yeah.
I go in, turn on the lights, do my thing, and then close up again.
Yeah.
But there's some other guys that usually show up. I like to have somebody to talk to. But as I say in the book, it isn't the exercise, it's the getting there.
Yeah.
You'll talk yourself right out of it.
Yeah.
And I said, if you only do 10 minutes, start getting there, and you'll be amazed how fast you come around. 90-year-olds can do it. It doesn't matter.
It's true.
And you need that oxygen blood going through the brain, too.
Yeah, and a great way to start your day.
Oh, yeah. You come back feeling younger.
Yeah. Now,
and I sing all the time. A lot of my friends, as you get older, you don't speak much, and their voices get very, very weak. And that's why I get up in the morning and start singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning."
That's awesome.
Well,
that's
ain't a beautiful day, I mean.
You know what? I had met you briefly about 10 years ago. You were walking through Palm Springs. I don't know why you were in Palm Springs. You had like a fanny pack, a backpack on, and you were walking down that street like you had your whole life ahead of you. You were there was a spring in your step that just motivated me. And I said, boy, this guy just, he knows how to live life. He just does.
Isn't that great? Yeah, I think a lot of older guys just throw in the towel before they should.
They do. Now, hobbies are important, too, and to keep up and keep your brain going. And you talk about a little bit about what you like doing. You work on 3D animation. Talk about open minds. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I started about 20 years ago. They came out with a little toy, and I've got just stuck with it. And now, of course, I'm using a program that they use in the movies. I'm not that good, but it's the process. Anything that you can lose hours in without realizing it is a good hobby.
Now, singing is also part. You say you sing every morning. The Fantastics. You can. By the way, there's an album out there that you can buy. There's videos out there, people that have taped you recording with I think it's about four or five other younger guys, and you guys do all kinds of a cappella songs. You do a lot of your favorites from the Mary Poppins and the Chitty Chitty Bang Bangs, but you do a lot
people love to hear that.
Oh, they do, but you do a lot of other great songs too, and it's put on a happy. It's all very positive, motivating songs that you're singing.
Well, we have such a good time. I love to harmonize. And these guys, they came to me.
Well, I'll tell you, with 90 years on the planet, any regrets, any things in life you would do over now that you've kind of, learned just a little bit about yourself and life itself?
Well, I would never smoke and I would never drink. Had a battle through both of those things. And for some reason, I turned down a movie with one of my idols, Cary Grant. I must have been busy or drunk. I don't know. But I didn't do the movie. It was one of those light, Doris Day kind of comedies. But, God, I just to be able to say I worked with him.
Yeah. No, I get that. But those are two big things in life that you learn. But the smoking, I mean, you smoked for a long time. But I think, but you keep moving and you keep active. And it's that the dancing and singing and everything else. That breathing that is helped rebuild your lungs and made you a stronger individual.
I think that is what saved me, the fact that I was always in movement, breathing.
Yeah.
I see the AMA just released a new list of things to do to prevent Alzheimer's, and exercise is number one.
Yeah, I'll tell you, that's the fastest growing disease that's out there for that generation, and it's pretty scary. That's a good tip as well. Dick, it has been such an honor and to have this opportunity to spend some time with you this evening.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN.
If he does well, he might forget about losing his job.
I know.
Ed's tried to hide it, but he's really been pretty blue about this, hasn't he?
Oh, I'll say. And it started me thinking, Alice. You can take the man out of the sewer, but you can't take the sewer out of the man.
Jackie Gleason, The Honeymooners, with the stars Art Carney, Audrey Meadows, and Joyce Randolph.
Originally a recurring sketch on Jackie Gleason's live variety show, The Honeymooners aired as film productions in 1955 and 56. And while only 39 episodes were shot, the characters were brought back for Gleason's 60s variety show, making a run on American television screens through the 1970s and to this day continuing in syndication, all with the stars Jackie Gleason, Art Carney, Audrey Meadows, and our guest who played the wife of Ralph's best friend Norton, Trixie Norton, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Joyce Randolph. Welcome to the program, Joyce.
Hello, dear. How nice to be here with you.
Oh, we are so excited to have you on the program. I can't express how excited I am to have the opportunity to spend some time with you. You are a television legend who was on one of the most successful sitcoms in the history of the medium.
Well, that's what they say, and we did it.
You did do it. You are a Midwest girl. You grew up in Detroit.
In Detroit, yes.
Yeah. You dipped into acting in school. I know you were in school plays, many as the lead.
Yes.
You know,
had to do that.
You had to do that. That's how you got started. And, you know, at a pretty young age, you knew you wanted to be an actress.
I have recently had a letter from a lady who knew my grandmother way up in northern Michigan. And she said that when we were all visiting there one summer, then she talked to me and that I was very young. And I said, I'm going to be an actress. Now, I don't remember that at all, but she tells me this, so maybe it's true.
Maybe it is true. Well, not only that, but I think you knew also at some point you wanted to also be in New York.
Yes, I knew that I couldn't do this in Detroit. I had to be in New York.
Coming from such a rich theater experience, it must have been familiar territory when you did live television in the early 1950s.
Yes, it wasn't too hard to do that. It was easy. I thought, you know, you'd change clothes behind the set because you only had about a minute.
Right.
And you didn't care who saw anything. And it was very hectic, but very good. And we loved it.
Yeah, you know, but at that time, because television was so new, people from the movies, people from the stage didn't look. You know, a lot of people didn't look up to television. They looked at it as like a step down, but those who embraced it really went somewhere with it.
Yeah, that's true, but it was looked down upon. You're right. Mm-hmm.
Now, how would you describe live television at the time when you were doing these shows? What was the experience like? It must have felt like Broadway, but I mean, I would think there was a lot of chaos and running around because it was a new medium to begin with. And then
yes, it was all new, and it was different from the stage, and we sort of loved being in something new. Yeah, there was some very experimental stuff very early on. I think General Motors did it, or General Electric, and you had to wear, like, blue lipstick, and the lights were so bright, it was terrible. And then the lights got better, and you didn't have to wear blue lipstick, but it was fun to do that very early stuff.
You know, it's funny, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but, you know, Studio 50, which is the Ed Sullivan Theater where Letterman did his shows, you know, he kept the air conditioning blowing pretty cold because the lights get so hot.
Yeah, he wanted it cold, I guess.
Yeah, in these older studios, so that's something for that. Now, you were on the Colgate Comedy Hour, then in 1951, you did a Clorette's commercial, which you almost didn't get because you were too tall for the person that was playing opposite of you, the gentleman that was playing opposite of you, so you wore flats.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
To do the spot, but you got it. And the Clorette's commercial was a big deal for many reasons, but it got you discovered by the great Jackie Gleason. Tell me a little bit about how that happened.
Yeah, well, I got the Clorette's commercial wearing flats, and then Joe Cates was the casting guy. This was still way back at
Dumont.
Channel 5, yeah. Dumont. And he called up and said, we're going to repeat that Clorette's commercial, so come in again. And I did, and we repeated it. And then a few weeks later, Joe Cates is on the phone again, and he said, could you come in and audition and try to look older? He said, Jackie has written a strange little skit with the writers. Jackie mostly wrote it, and going to audition a few women, so you come in too. And I did, and Jackie asked me to do it. I guess I did it, and, you know, with like one rehearsal, thank God I was able to do that with one rehearsal, and he evidently liked it, and it just sat there that night on television. Nobody knew what this was with this strange little skit with, excuse me, Gleason playing a sort of old vaudevillian who came back to his hometown and talked to the woman he should have married long ago, which was me.
Okay.
And then a few weeks later, Joe Cates called up and he said, "Oh, have you seen this thing we've been doing?" Excuse me, called The Honeymooners. And I said, "No, my roommate Diana and I, we don't even have a television set."
And yeah, you worked on television, early television, but you never saw yourself really on television. Yeah, it's funny. That's how it was back then.
So he said, "Well, you know, it's Art Carney is the sewer worker, but Jackie Gleason is the bus driver, and at that time, Pert Kelton was Alice, the wife." And he said, "Jackie said, get me that serious actress for Trixie." That's all he knew. Serious actress, didn't know my name or anything, but he put me in it that way. It's not good to fall into something that way. I mean, it's wonderful, yet you don't have any agent representing you. You never get any money.
Right. And this was, by the way, this was on the DuMont Television Network on the Cavalcade of Stars at one point.
Yeah, what it was. It was on Jackie Gleason's Cavalcade of Stars.
From your perspective, tell us about the role of Trixie. What did they want you to do on the onset of this for these first episodes?
They just gave me the script and you said the words. Nobody told me what to do. You played it the way you wanted to play it. That's all. And it seemed to satisfy them, you know. I was really, in a way, playing myself, which is stupid, but that's the way it was. Yeah. And it worked out okay.
Yeah. Well, and plus it was a story, you know, TV movies always kind of glamorized life quite a bit. And this was not that. This was the lower side of growing up in New York. How are the Cramdons, okay, different from the Nortons on this show? How did you see them two differently?
Well, they were all very poor in Brooklyn, but Jackie was all Mr. Cramden was always losing money, whereas our Carney somehow seemed to make money, and our apartment was much better looking than theirs.
Yes, it was.
Everybody commented on, which was really kind of silly that ours could be that much better looking, but it was.
It was comparatively. I mean,
Jackie wanted his to be very plain, very poor looking. Evidently, he had grown up very poor in Brooklyn, and he wanted it that way.
It was a reflection of life.
Yeah.
For him. Yeah. People used to send curtains and other household items to CBS that the Cramdons could have
them to some hospital.
Yeah, is that what happened? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, with all the items that you sent. What was it like? And I know this is a long answer. So what was it like working with Jackie? You know, I know he was in control of everything from what I've heard. He didn't rehearse that much. What was life like working with Jackie Gleason?
Well, a little difficult because he wasn't overly friendly, you know. He could be very nice, but he could also be a little bit mean if he wanted to and give orders. But he wanted things his way, and things were done his way. And he just wasn't going to rehearse much because he said it's not funny if it's over-rehearsed. It's got to be fresh and spontaneous. And he was right. He was right. Yeah. With us, it worked. So we didn't have long rehearsal schedules at all, like people on the Moses Sid Caesar show over on NBC. We were on CBS. They were NBC. And they worked all week to put their show on. And, you know, our June Taylor dancers worked all week, yes, but the skits didn't. And that's the way it was. That's the way he wanted it. He was slightly a difficult man. Not, you know, I didn't want to be overly friendly with him, so it was fine.
Well, and you know, when we're talking about watching the series today, you can see that there's anticipation from the actors, from all four of you on the set, because there's also a little ad-libbing that goes on in these shows as well.
Yes.
You know, so I could see you're all kind of anticipating, like, okay, what's coming next, and am I going to do my line, or do I need to do something else? You could see it, that it was like a live
Well, I hope we couldn't see it too much.
But in a good way.
Yeah. But Audrey was a brilliant girl. She knew every word in the script. She knew everybody's lines, particularly Jackie's. She knew she had to, you know, and she was wonderful.
Yeah, I was going to say there was a way that Audrey would cue Jackie and others when if they missed their cue or missed their line, or she'd look over to an area where, you know, if Jackie was supposed to walk over to the fridge, she'd look over to the fridge to kind of give him a clue of where he was going. Mm-hmm. She kind of was a little bit of an associate director on the set because she had to keep things focused.
Yes.
Yeah. But she, again, you mentioned, wasn't the original. The original Mrs. Cramden, Pert Kelton played that
Pert
role.
Pert Kelton, yes, did it when we were way back at, you know, Channel 5, Dumont. She was wonderful and really very authentic Brooklyn with a really authentic accent and everything. And but then CBS bought us, and CBS said that lady is not going to work on CBS. She's listed in red channels. And that was a crazy thing in those days, assuming that people in red channels were communists.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a bad time.
They accused Lucille Ball at one point of being a communist.
Yes,
yeah.
I know. It was really a terrible thing to be happening. And so Pert could not come along with us, no, and he was upset. He had to quickly look for somebody. He didn't like to audition at all, but he did find Audrey very quickly, and luckily she turned out to be wonderful. And so that was what happened, and Pert.
She almost didn't get the role either, because I've heard stories that she came in looking too nice, and Jackie said, "No, she's not. She needs to look a little rougher."
She had to make herself look funny and rough, and then have pictures taken in that state. And when he saw the pictures, he said, "Oh, this girl will be great." And they said, "Well, you already met her." He said, "No, this is good. Well, this girl will be fine."
That's funny. They sort of tricked him,
and it worked out very well.
It did. Tell me about Art Carney working with Art as Ed Norton.
Oh, a very sweet man, so talented. He could do anything, and very shy and quiet. Nothing. He was nothing like Ed Norton, but he could play Ed Norton beautifully, and he was just a wonderful, nice guy.
Yeah.
And you know, when we don't have rehearsals, you don't get to know these people. You don't go to lunch with them. You don't get to know them. It was sad in a way, you know.
Here's something I didn't know until recently, is the episodes, which look like they're very much taped, those were live shows.
We always work live. He never would work on tape. We were always, always live. Mm-hmm.
Which surprised me, because the quality is that of an I Love Lucy episode, a Dick Van Dyke Show episode. It looks like it's completely edited, and it took, you know, a couple weeks to put together. It surprised me that you were all live all the time.
Always live.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, there was single sponsors at the time of the entire program, and I believe Buick was a sponsor, and Buick wanted another season of The Honeymooners as a single up, and Jackie said, you know, I don't think we can top this.
You know, he said, our writers can't think of any more stories.
It's amazing.
They were already plagiarizing themselves.
Yeah. I mean, there was stories, obviously. He did skits and so forth afterwards, but he just felt as a single standing series.
Couldn't do it again.
What was like life on the set like? I mean, this was really, you know, I've seen pictures of behind the scenes. It was a stage. It was a curtain. It was mostly focused on the Cramden's apartment. What was the time on the set like between takes, working with everybody on the set?
Well, there were no takes because we were absolutely live.
That's right.
We were absolutely live, and you just rehearsed it quickly, and Jackie would disappear into his dressing room. We'd all run up to Audrey's dressing room, and her manager, Val, would read in Jackie's words, and we'd go over and over what we were going to do that night at 8 o'clock, because we had to, you know. He wasn't going to do it with us, but evidently he worked in his room, and we were all together, and we got it on at 8 o'clock.
Now, this is now 60 years ago we're talking about here. So do you remember, when you watch any of these shows today, do you remember actually doing these shows live? Do you remember the moment that you were on the set doing these, or is it just such a distant memory?
Sort of.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange.
Yeah. I bet, like an out-of-body kind of thing, watching yourself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned there's a lot of ad-libbing on the set. I heard...
Not a lot. A little.
But you mentioned the roller skating episode, which was...
We didn't know what was going to happen because he never would put on any roller skates. He just put them on that night and went on and did it. And we didn't know how it was going to work out, but it was okay.
So you just kind of flew by the seat of your pants.
Yeah.
Did you have any favorite episodes now that, you know, it's been all this time and you've watched these a million times? Is there any favorites of yours?
Well, anyone in which I had more than five lines, I began to like that one. Sure, I was there for quite a while.
I bet. Over 100 sketches were made also with the 39 episodes, and that's what amazed me. Now, he moved to Florida. At some point, he said, I'm going to move to Florida. But he replaced you and Audrey. And part of it was, you know, did he want to just freshen things up? I know you wanted to stay in New York, so you weren't going to move to Florida anyway.
No way.
No, but it's funny how, you know, all of a sudden there was just a whole new group. It's, you know, and I know they're out in DVD, and I remember watching some of them when they were a kid. It just wasn't the same.
No, they're not very good, and even in color, it was too nice. You know what I mean? It made them look rich and old, and that's not what the Honeymooners were. They were poor, you know, and young, and
right.
It was all wrong. But it ran a number of seasons. Amazing,
it did.
Sheila McRae and Jane Keane. Jane was an old, longtime friend of his and put her in as Trixie, which didn't bother me in the least. I was happy with a husband and a baby, you know. And Sheila McRae... she wasn't as good as Audrey. She just wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
And
Audrey,
I hear Jackie had to work with her, and he hated working with anybody.
That's great. Yeah, Audrey did come back for a couple of those
reunions. She was friend with Jackie, and he brought her in to do a few things,
Now, you went back to theater, your first love. You became a mom. So, I mean, you took a different turn in your career.
I was busy being a mom, did some summer stock, you know, some musical stock, and it was fine. My husband was doing better and better. I didn't have to work anyhow.
Now, tell me about the Lambs Club. You've talked about that in interviews before. You've been a member for years.
Forever, yeah. Yes. It's the oldest theatrical club in America, but it was more or less founded in London 150 years ago. And actors then were considered to be ruffians, and they were not welcome in places, but they were welcome in Charles and Mary Lamb's home. And they enjoyed that. And then things happened, and they would emigrate to New York because theaters were on 14th Street then, and it was becoming more and more popular. And theaters moved to 23rd Street, and more actors came over. And they were tired of meeting in the back rooms of bars and everything. And they said, we miss the Lambs so much. And they said, well, let's start our own Lambs. And they did. Theaters were on 23rd Street, and I don't know where they met then, but they did build their own building on 44th Street between 6th and 7th. It's still there to this day, though we don't own it anymore, but it's still there. And it was very successful, you know, with a huge membership in those days. And it was before so many actors moved to Hollywood, you know.
Sure.
And the old days at the old club were wonderful.
And your late husband led the group for a while.
The president of the club is called the Shepherd. And my husband was Shepherd for the last 11 years of his life. He was a very popular Shepherd, and everybody loved him.
That's pretty cool. Now, I remember, Joyce, when I was watching Comic Relief. It was about 1990. And it was a few years after Jackie passed already, but they brought you, Audrey Meadows, Art Carney, on stage.
Yes.
And first time that you were really on stage together for maybe 30 years. I will tell you the ridiculous excitement I felt seeing all of you up there. That must have been surreal.
It was unbelievable. The three of us started crying. When you walk out on that stage and you see this whole audience get up and applaud, we started to cry. And Art says, you think I was Marlon Brando. I said, you're better.
But you are, you know.
It was quite a night. Oh.
But legends. You are legends. I mean, if you really look at, like, the top shows or early shows of television, you know, again, people talk about Lucy and Dick Van Dyke, but The Honeymooners is right there. I mean, that is one of the most iconic shows of the 20th century.
Yeah, we were right there with Lucille Ball, yeah.
Joyce, honestly, it has been an honor to have you on the program. You are a legend, big part of one of the most successful award-winning legendary series of all time, and I'm so glad you took the time for us tonight.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Oh, yeah. I think that, I mean, if God had meant us to be together, he'd have put us together. Well, look what he'd done. He put you over in Africa. He put the rest of us in all the white countries.
Well, you must have told him where we were, because somebody came and got us.
Dave Player on 720 WGN. Television producer and broadcasting legend Norman Lear has enjoyed a long career in television and film, and is a political and social activist and philanthropist. Norman's work is legendary, the renowned creator of such iconic television shows as All in the Family, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Mary Hartman, and so many others. He remade our television culture from the ground up. At their peak, his programs were viewed by 120 million people a week, with stories that dealt with the most serious issues of the day: racism, poverty, abortion, menopause, swingers, politics, and so much more, yet leaving audiences howling with laughter. His signature series, All in the Family, held the number one spot from 71 to 76 in the Nielsen ratings, and it was called the fourth greatest TV show of all time by TV Guide. It earned 22 Emmy Awards, including 4 for Best Comedy Series. And in his new book, Even This I Get to Experience, Norman opens up with all the candor, humor, and wisdom to be expected from one of America's greatest living storytellers. And we are thrilled he's joining us tonight. Mr. Lear, good evening to you.
Good evening to you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, I'll tell you, I read your book over the last week, and it's 92 years in the making. I thought it would be I thought it would be volumes based on your career.
Well, it could be volumes if I told every minute of it, but I spared you that.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Fair enough. And I knew this was a true labor of love. It took you about 6 years to put it together.
It did. Well, I'd been noting. I knew 20 years ago I was going to do it, and I had boxes of correspondence and notes and other projects I worked on that filled in, and other, you know, adventures in the media. So I was note-taking, and 6 years actually in the writing.
So, Norman, it was when All in the Family, you started talking about All in the Family, you brought a British sitcom to U.S. television, but it wasn't an easy road to get that first episode on the air. I think you originally started producing it for ABC.
I did. The ABC bought it, and we made the pilot with Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton, two other young people. I knew Rob Reiner since he was 6 or so years old, but I thought him too young for it at that time. And so we had two other young people, but the same script as the one that went on the air eventually. And ABC, they had the right to ask me to make it again, which would hold it for another year, or put it on. They elected not to put it on and had me make it again, so they controlled it for 2 years. So we made it again also with O'Connor and Stapleton and two other young people. And
same script. Same script, though, right?
Same script. Well, 100% the same script.
Yeah.
My theory was you can't get wetter than wet. We're going to jump in the water with Archie, 360 degrees of him, and we're going to get wet together. And so it's the same script 3 years later when CBS, a new president, came into that role, Bob Wood at CBS and Fred Silverman, his associate, and they bought it.
But, you know, see, even then, when they bought it, CBS wanted to pull the plug almost at the last minute, right up to the opening.
They wanted to run the second show we made first,
yeah.
And it wasn't the script that I intended to show 360 degrees of Archie Bunker. So we went to within 20 minutes of the broadcast in the East. In those days, still, it's 3 hours later in
sure.
In 3 hours earlier, but 3 hours later in New York.
Well, and what's amazing, right in the opening segment, is what they had a problem with. You know, okay, here we have a married couple. Nothing happened. The camera saw nothing. They just didn't like what was being alluded to. Please explain that.
Well, they walked into, they had gone to church. It was a Sunday morning. It was their anniversary. Mm-hmm. The kids were preparing a surprise brunch for them. Archie hated the sermon, didn't like the pastor either, left the church. They came in arguing about the sermon. And while the kids were alone in the house, which happened very rarely, Mike coaxed Gloria into going upstairs. It was as they were going up and were just lost for a moment at the top of the stairs when the bunkers came in. They came running down. Archie guessed what was happening. And the line that was in contention was, Archie saying, 11:10 on a Sunday morning. And I said, well, what, it's an innocuous line. But no, it isn't. It's pointed to something we all know what it's about.
Absolutely.
Well, of course we know what it's about, but then again, they're married.
Right, right.
What's the problem?
Yeah, I guess that it was Sunday. I don't know in this day and age, but yeah.
I don't know. But that was the final that had to come out. Now, that script could have lived very well without that line. So I wasn't fighting for some for the line. It was the meaning behind it. It was so innocuous that it was common sense to understand that if I said, okay, let's take that little innocuous line out, that I would lose every battle after that.
Absolutely.
It would never stop.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, I didn't look at it like the giant war it seemed to be in hindsight. It was just, I can't convince you this, or the silliness will prevail.
Absolutely. Great, great hindsight as well. And I know the first show, too, had a disclosure in the beginning of it even, you know, just to warn viewers what they were about to see, which I don't believe there was any reaction. I mean, maybe a handful, but it was like, great show.
Yeah. It was, what do they call that when they, before they put it on, they take it back.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
From a true audience's own.
Yeah, right.
This was a whole paragraph.
Right. Right. Now, hands down, All in the Family is clearly the most, probably one of the most important, if not the most important show of the 20th century. Did you know at the time how important this show was going to be in television history?
No. I was a guy with, I had two kids. And I was fighting to make a living. It was the beginning of a career. And this was work. We were working. And the other guys were and gals were in the same situation. We were all fighting to make a living as writers. The difference, I think, was that I was born into a serious situation.
Yeah.
I got to understand the foolishness of the human condition out of the tragedy and the problems that exist there.
Sure.
So I gravitated to writing out of that. And our little team of writers, this was, you have to remember, a giant collaboration. I mean, I wasn't alone here. And I created the show and the characters, but I had a great team of writers, men and women, who were devoted to it. But they were devoted first to their own families. They were men and women who were married or single and part of the culture. They looked at everything that impacted their kids, their families, and themselves, economically, socially, sexually, whatever, illness, all of that. And that's what we wrote from, the reality of the lives we were living.
And then in front of the camera, you know, I know Carol, you know, based on what you wrote, he developed his character after a cab driver he knew. What was it like working with Carol O'Connor?
Well, it was as difficult as it could be on the one hand, and it was miraculous and life-giving on the other. I mean, to see a guy who he fought a great deal about what he was doing, didn't like this, didn't like that. I came to believe he had to go through something, which only he understood at some real depth. And then he'd come out Archie Bunker. And when he came out of Archie Bunker, there were none of us who could write the dialogue as well as Archie could fume it.
Yeah, right. No, right, right.
It spilled out of him.
But there was a lot of passion, I mean, between both of you, obviously. You running the show, him being the star of the show. I mean, you both, you know, developed had opinions, and you learned to work with one another. But, you know, there was a lot of, and I say it with all due respect, but there was a lot of passion on both sides. And so,
oh, there was. There was a tremendous amount and a lot of anger and so forth. But, I mean, I was so grateful for the character. And, you know, these things happen in creative enterprises. And he had his own ideas. And sometimes, by the way, it isn't like the man was always wrong.
Yeah.
He bettered everything he touched in the long run.
What was your best remembered story working with Carol? I assume it might be the episode when he was stuck in the elevator.
That's the one that leaps to mind because it was kind of it was in an elevator, five people trapped in an elevator that got stuck on a high floor, and one of them due to have a baby in a couple of weeks, and the tension and so forth of that moment causes her to go into labor, and Archie was having a relationship with one black dude. And this Hispanic couple and
some of the funniest dialogue ever.
And yes, it was a hilarious situation for him to be in, and I'm sure he understood that. But it was also he was with four players that were not well known. He's the star of the show. It's, you know, he has to deliver in that confinement enormously. And a baby is going to be born on the floor of that elevator. The camera isn't going to be there. It's going to be on Archie's face. And, I mean, as I say it, I think about how glorious it was as an idea and how super glorious he made it as an actor. That moment is indelible.
Yeah, I mean, just like you said in the first episode, you know, there was a lot of things that were alluded to. There was a lot of things that were alluded to in the end of this episode. You never really saw anything, but you saw the action and you saw the emotion of what was happening just in Carol's face.
Yes, yeah, and, you know, I can't name, over all the years, I don't know how many actors I could name that could possibly pull that off.
Yeah, Jean Stapleton, I know you had a wonderful relationship with her.
Yes. Jean Stapleton, somebody asked me early in our relationship and the show's history, somebody said, what's Jean Stapleton like? And I heard myself saying, she's always where she is. And there was some time later, I really dwelled on that and thought, oh, my God, how remarkable is that?
Yeah.
She's always where she is. And then I started to reflect on me.
Yeah.
And I couldn't say that and wish to.
Yeah, you know what were your favorite episode with Gene? Because Gene was the focus of so many episodes.
Probably, I don't know what my favorite was. What my mind leaped to was we wanted Gene to lose her faith in God and examine what that would mean, and we found a way easily that would cause that. There was a Beverly LaSalle who was a transgender.
Yeah.
And Edith looked at her as the woman she wished to be, appeared to be, you know. And it didn't cross, nothing negative crossed her mind. That's who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And she is killed by a gang for the reason for her sexuality. And Edith can't understand a God who would allow that. It loses her faith. And then we had weeks. We couldn't run or make and run the first show without having the second show, Edith gaining it, regaining her faith.
Right.
And it took weeks thinking about that. So we couldn't make the first. We had the script. Until somebody asked the question, well, what happens to Archie when Edith loses her faith? And we all realized in an instant, he goes to pieces.
Yeah.
He needs her strength, her strength starting with the fact that she adored him, and there's nothing he could say that could stop that. Talk about strength.
So many spinoffs. You know, at a time, there wasn't a lot of spinoffs in the 60s or the 50s. This show, All in the Family, generated so many spinoffs. The first one was Maude, correct?
Yes. You know, the word spinoffs always interested me. I always thought about you bring on a player that you think can work in his or her own show, and she's kind of a Bush League player. Mm-hmm. And what you're trying to do is groom her or him for the majors. That was the terminology I always used thinking about it. Well, we wanted on All in the Family, we wanted somebody to come along that would reach through the depth of a lot of years to beat the hell out of them. Mm-hmm. You know, well, I learned in my family there's something like an old relative with a grudge.
Yeah,
you didn't invite Gert to the wedding. How could you have done that 27 years ago? That person coming in with that. So Maude was a cousin as a girl, and best friend of Edith's.
Yeah, the whole family was sick. The whole family was sick, and Maudie was called to come take care. I remember the episode. It was absolutely vintage because it was the first time I think I saw Archie really beat up by somebody.
Yes. And well, it needed to be Arthur playing that role.
Yeah.
But with that grudge that came back, that came over the years.
Now, from Maude came Good Times. Did you get flack at the time because of the portrayal of this black family, you know, in Chicago, that it was more negative?
We got flack a couple of years in. There was some flack. Some of it was helpful because it was about why is the only black character supporting a family working three jobs? Why is it that's not the truth in America? People move up, move on. And several African-American newspapers carried stories like that or hints of that feeling. And that motivated us. We were thinking about them, the actors, to do the Jeffersons, but it certainly motivated moving on up.
Absolutely. Right. Which I would say you remedied that with another sitcom. So the Jeffersons, and I forgot, you know, obviously the Jefferson's came after Good Times, and it surprises me always because really they were, you know, so prevalent in the first season of the show. When you develop those characters, you know, Isabel Sanford, and I know Sherman Hemsley came a little bit later, did you ever think in the back of your mind, here is another show, or did it come to you kind of later after you did Good Times?
No, I Bush League characters were everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you couldn't hire a good actor without wondering if that good actor shouldn't move up. And that motivated as much of the thinking as anything else. Wouldn't it be fun to see this glorious performer in his or her own show?
Sure. And then there was One Day at a Time, and I had read that there, you know, when Maude, you know, when the abortion issue came up on Maude, this was a episode originally written for Bonnie Franklin on One Day at a Time. What decided to go a different route and a whole different show with this subject matter?
Well, it was written originally, and not that it was the same script as it, you know, that was finally done.
Yeah.
Because Joan Harris, who later created Golden Girls, wrote, is responsible for the abortion episodes on All in the Family.
Mm-hmm.
The one, I can't remember who, but it was the team that wrote it for Bonnie Franklin. But we were, I don't remember exactly why we hadn't made it, but we certainly intended to make it. When somebody came in with a newspaper article about a woman in her 70s that was raped, and as we talked about that, we thought, you know, rape is usually considered what they look for first is what was the girl doing to entice the guy?
Yeah, horrible.
Was her shirt too short? Or, mm-hmm. So this kind of thinking and speculation about. And certainty that older women, as a result of seeing this story,
mm-hmm.
are raped too, caused us to say, let's do it with Jean and not with a young woman.
Gotcha. Well, I will tell you, you know, One Day at a Time, Mary Hartman, Fernwood Tonight, Sanford and Son, so many others, Silver Spoons, Facts of Life, Different Strokes, that just came from you, Square
no,
Peg.
It didn't all come from me. Well, you know, a giant collaboration.
Absolutely, but still, out of all the other shows outside of All in the Family, what show would you say you're most proud of outside of All in the Family?
Well, I would say Maude, Good Times at Jefferson, and Mary Hartman.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Mary Hartman was at one spectacular thing about it, and that was that it set up something at the beginning. And, you know, it was on five nights a week,
so
there were several hundred episodes. And it concluded on the same thing in which it began. And it wished to explore the impact of the media on a simple housewife, and the media drove her crazy at the end.
Yeah.
And her, on the David Susskind show, as a result of the inquiry of three hard-hitting media bullshitters, I can't say that, can I?
Whatever you'd like.
They drove her crazy, and that's one of the best acting jobs I've ever seen.
Very cool. Now, I also know you've stayed very active over the decades to speak out for the Bill of Rights. Obviously, producing these shows, I would think you would have to be, and specifically the First Amendment, the People for the American Way. In the late 80s, you began the Environmental Media Association to make sure that the entertainment industry was, you know, environmentally responsible, which is very early on when you think about the late 80s. Declare yourself to get people out to vote, and countless others. And here's a little-known fact that I think people might not know. In 2001, you and your wife purchased one of the first published copies of the United States Declaration of Independence. How cool was that?
It couldn't have been cooler. This was one of 26 known to exist in the world. It was the only one in private hands. And it was this group were printed the night of July 4th, 1776.
Wow.
Unlike the one that was signed. That was signed over months. And there's only one copy. But this was printed to be sent by horseback around the 13 colonies. And there are 20-some left. And so I looked at it as our country's birth certificate.
Absolutely.
The night of. And we had the best time in the history of good times sending it around the country with the cooperation of major sponsors and the U.S. Postal Service. And it was fabulous.
Well, that's what I love about it is not only did you purchase it, though, but you took it on the road. You let people see it. You shared it with the country. That's pretty cool.
Well, that was its purpose. No. I mean, I didn't buy it to hang it on a wall.
I hear you. I'll tell you what, nominated for an Academy Award, inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1984, four Emmy Awards, the Humanist Award, a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, the National Medal of Arts, and so much more. Absolutely incredible, and you are a legend in your own time, and I'm thrilled you spent some time with us tonight.
I couldn't have enjoyed it more. Thank you.
A true television icon that we all grew up with is the legendary Barbara Eden, best known from five seasons in the NBC hit comedy series I Dream of Jeannie. But it was nearly a decade earlier that she got her start in an RKO film called Back from Eternity, and the following year made one of her first television appearances on I Love Lucy. She has starred in dozens of feature films and television series with co-stars like Elvis Presley, Paul Newman, Lucille Ball, Clint Eastwood, Larry Hagman, Tony Randall, John Forsythe, and so many others. Then there was Vegas, Atlantic City, and on the theater scene throughout the country. And she even lived right here in Chicago for a number of years. And joining us tonight to talk about her storied career is the legendary actress herself, singer and Hollywood star, Barbara Eden. Hello there, Barbara, and welcome to the program.
Hi, David. How are you?
I am excellent. I'm so glad that you're joining us tonight. And I will admit to having a big crush on you growing up.
Oh, you mean you don't still have it?
I still have it. Oh, no. I still have the crush. No, you know, we were talking before the interview that I had the pleasure of spending some time with you a few years ago when you were in Chicago, and you are just as lovely as ever.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. So how did the role of Jeannie come along?
Well, I had been reading about it and the trade magazines, you know, Variety Reporter, and reading about all these girls who were testing, and they were all very tall brunettes and beauty contest winners. I mean, Miss Italy, Miss
Miss Syria, Miss Israel, Miss Greece.
You know? So some exotic, you know.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, well, that's not for me. Mm-hmm. And then my agent sent me a script one day, and I read it, and I thought, this sounds very familiar. And he called me that afternoon, and he said, did you read it? I said, yes. He said, did you like it? I said, I loved it. He said, well, they would really like you for that part. Just like that. And I said, do they know what I look like? And he said, well, I don't know. They must, because they want you for the part. They've made an offer. But it's contingent upon you meeting Sidney Sheldon. He's lives in New York, and he's coming into town, and he'll be there tomorrow for tea at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Nice.
And I said, all right. And I went over, and I met Sidney. We got along very well, and that's how I got the part.
Now, were you pregnant at the time of the pilot or right after?
No, it was after.
Okay.
It was after. It was quite a bit after. And the doctor actually gave me the news that I was pregnant, which I was thrilled. I was just over the moon. We had tried so long to have a baby. And then my agent called and said the show has sold. On the same day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that night I called Sidney and said, I have to talk to you, right now. And he was having dinner at someone's home, a well-known writer, I can't think of his name. Oh, Buck Henry.
Okay, oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's at Buck Henry's house, and he told me where to go, and I met him there, went into his little office at the side, and he looked at me and jokingly said, yeah, you're pregnant, like that. And I said, yes. And I can't do your show, with a big grin on my face.
Wow.
Which was terrible.
Yeah.
And he said, no. And I said, I'm sorry. I said, it just, this is unusual for us, but we're very happy that we're going to have a baby. And I was the luckiest girl in the world, because Sidney and the studio worked very hard to get everything ready faster than they would have.
Mm-hmm.
And I did 13 shows pregnant.
In that costume. So I would have to think there was some pretty creative blocking or standing behind things.
Oh, that plus many, many scarves.
Oh.
I laughed. I used to call myself a walking tent. I flowed with scarves.
You know, if I had to think about it, I guess in the black and white episodes, the early episodes, you did have these long, very glamorous, like 5-foot scarves kind of flowing around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I stood in back of a lot of chairs. And one time, it was funny, Gene Nelson was directing us, and he was a dear friend at the time. And his wife still is my good friend. But they had chosen a red bathing suit, a two-piece, for me to wear. And it was all set out there, and I looked at it, and I looked at Joey, the girl who was in charge of wardrobe, and I said, Joey, I can't wear that. And she said, well, just try it on. Let's see what it looks like. I put it on. It was horrible. It was just so embarrassing. I said, no, tell Gene I can't wear the bathing suit. I mean, God, I was 5 months pregnant. That's
yeah, and a little bit. Yeah.
Gene came running over to my dressing room and said, Barbara, you've never been a diva. What's the matter? And I said, well, I can't wear the bathing. I hadn't made a big deal out of it. You know, I just said no. Yeah. And I said, I can't wear it. I'm pregnant, Gene. I guess he'd forgotten during all the shooting. And he said, well, put it on. I said, I'll put it on. I will not walk out in front of the crew. I said, you come here and see it. And he said, okay. So I put the thing on. I put a robe on over it. And when he came over to the door, I just flashed him. I opened it. I said, see? And I closed it again. And he went, oh, yeah, you're right.
That's great.
I think what they did was put me in a tire tube on me.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, on the side of the pool.
Yeah. Why not?
That was it.
Since so many of us have seen these episodes, Barbara, over and over throughout the years, you can tell that the cast had such great chemistry together.
Well, Larry and I were in sync. Even later, in later years, when we
toured with Love Letters, it was like, it was as though I was just at home with a family member. And I know he felt the same way. Our rhythms, our timing, everything was in sync.
Yeah, you've done plays together. You also did some Dallas together. I remember that also. In the late 70s. And I know how much you enjoyed working with him, and you had a long-lasting friendship. But at that time, you had some frustrations with him as well.
Well, not really. I didn't really. A lot of other people on the set did. Mm-hmm. He made things a little difficult for himself, really. But it never affected me or our working together, ever.
Well, that's good to hear.
He was very, very nice with me.
Very cool. Now, how complicated was all the filming? You know, because obviously, you know, we're talking the 1960s, and special effects weren't, you know, obviously what they are today. They look great. I mean, even when you look at them today, it's amazing how smooth everything really does look, you know, when you're doing these. But it wasn't, you know... I would assume because it wasn't a typical sitcom, the hours were much longer.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was, and we couldn't have an audience,
right?
Because of the magic, and it was very complicated. When we were flying through the air, we were really flying through the air.
Exactly.
with wires attached, mm-hmm. things like that. A lot of green screen. Which we had to adapt to. It didn't adapt to us. It was fun, though. I enjoyed it.
You know, it was a purely fun show. There are shows I used to love when I was a kid. You know, and I know some of you listening will agree, and you watch them now, and they're awful. I mean, seriously, like, I can't get through. You know, my kids were watching Gilligan's Island. I thought, well, I'm going to sit down and watch this, or The Monkees, and I thought, this is going to be fun. And I got to tell you, it wasn't really that great. You watch Genie, and it is timeless as can be. It is funny as it was back then, and the slapstick, the comedy, the humor, the writing is just a joy to watch.
I am so happy you think so.
Yeah, seriously. Seriously.
That makes me feel really good.
I bet. Now, I've heard you talk about the costume before, that it wasn't as revealing as you might think. It was, you know, people, and maybe that was a good thing, that, you know, you kind of led people to believe that it might be a little bit more revealing, but it really wasn't. And the press at the time made a bigger deal out of it than anyone else.
Well, it was a joke to begin with. It was a writer from the Hollywood Reporter, and he'd come on the set, and he'd say, do you have a belly button? And I'd say, Nicola Peek, you know. Things were very cheap then.
Yeah.
And so he'd started writing about it, just as a joke.
Yeah.
Does she or doesn't she have a belly button? And of course, it peeked out every once in a while. It was there. The trousers were not up at the high waist; they were just sort of riding on my hips.
Yeah.
And then George Slaughter decided he wanted to premiere my navel on Laugh-In.
Right.
And the minute he told NBC that, everyone went, "Oh, MG, yeah. she has one. You know, can't show that." So I was not allowed to go on Laugh-In. I wasn't allowed. And they suddenly were very careful about my trousers. They lined the pantaloons.
Oh, jeez.
Which hadn't been lined before. I had panties and long pantyhose on. Yeah. Both.
Yeah.
So, but no. They lined them.
Even more so. Wow. Well, I know the censors, they were pretty aware of this, too. Because, you know, there was a story I've heard you tell, I think it was in your book, too, that about the smoke underneath the bedroom door.
Oh, yes, Larry.
Yeah.
Poor Larry, he had a scene, of course, where the bottle was in the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And was the bottle in the bedroom? No, it wasn't. It wasn't in the bedroom. But he locked me out, and I turned to smoke and went underneath the door. And you could hear Larry's voice, but not me. And he said, "Jane," you know how he used to say.
Oh, yeah.
And then all of a sudden the smoke came out from under the door. And it was funny. Cute to see.
I get it. Yeah, yeah.
But no, the censor said absolutely not. They cut that scene. And then they said no bottle in the bedroom.
Wow.
We hadn't even thought of taking the bottle in the bedroom before that. It's so funny.
Wow.
Well, it's amusing.
It is. It is. But, I mean, obviously the two characters got together, you know, and I know it kept it interesting that for so many years you weren't married. There was maybe some light flirting and all that. But at toward the end, they said, well, you know what, we're gonna bring these characters together and get married. Were you fond of that?
No.
Yeah.
No, I didn't think they should ever have been married. As I said before, she wasn't human.
Right.
Absolutely was not human. And that was what was funny about the show, was she was so convinced that she would be a person, a human person.
Sure.
Not a genie person.
Right, right.
And it just made her a housewife, and that isn't what she was.
No, not at all. So what was your relationship like with some of the other supporting characters on the show? I know many, many of them are gone, but, you know, what was it like working on the set?
It was wonderful. It was just, you know, that was the happiest time of my life. At that moment, I had my baby, I had my work, and I enjoyed it. And everyone on that set was an angel.
I know you're still friends with Bill Daly. You still see him around at
I just saw Bill 2 weeks ago, actually.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. He lives in New Mexico, but we see each other every once in a while at personal appearances and things.
That's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's so cool. How did you find out, and you shared the story with me before, how did you find out the series was canceled? Because, you know, there's so many, you know, oh, it's the lead up to the final episode and all this other stuff. That's really not the way it was done back then.
Nobody told us anything.
Yeah.
No, we didn't know. The last day, I think, we knew. The last day of shooting.
Wow.
Yeah.
That it was just coming to an end, no fanfare, no final episode. It's just
no, that's it. Just willowed away.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a shame. That's how they did it back then. Did you get any souvenirs from the set? Did you get, you know, any prop pieces? Like, was everything just the next day pretty much done?
Of course I did.
Yeah.
Of course I did.
Because you
had my bottle.
Okay.
You think I was going to leave that? Heavens.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's now in a safety deposit box.
Mm-hmm.
Because after the earthquake here, I thought,
smart.
We're not going to leave it on the shelf anymore.
No. Was the original, that was a Jim Beam bottle, wasn't it?
That is correct.
Yeah.
It was a Christmas bottle that year.
I have a very vintage bar in my house, like a 1960s bar, and it was green. I think there was green ones and red ones.
I didn't know they had red ones.
Yeah, they're red, and they had a little handle on them too, which was a little different. But there was like a pink one. It was almost like a pinkish red, and the green ones. And I had bought from somebody who's authorized through Sony, who hand painted these bottles. And when I had met you, I must have been 10 years ago. You were at WGN Television,
mm-hmm.
And I was there. And I have a picture of you and I and my bottle.
And your bottle.
That I have.
You think it's your bottle. It's
well, it is your bottle. It is absolutely your bottle. Well, what's funny is after showing the kids the show last summer when we watched it so much, and they came up to my den where I do have it on a shelf high enough where nobody can get to it, my youngest, you know, I opened up the cork, and man, he was looking in there trying to see if he could find you. And they're like, he was.
You know, someone makes those bottles.
Yeah.
And sells them.
Yeah.
And he has one with the hole, the banquette, and the genie looking up at you.
Really?
Yeah, you turn the light on and you can see all of those things inside.
That's awesome. That is awesome. But you didn't get a costume.
No.
No.
No, I didn't. In fact, they would not let me have one.
That's awful.
It's too bad because they didn't take good care of them. And there aren't any there. I did a commercial for Lexus.
Remember that in the late 90s?
Yes, mm-hmm. And they copied the costume. So luckily I have that one.
Well, I saw you in an appearance with Bill Clinton.
Yeah, that's the one.
did you use it again? But, I mean, I got to tell you something. You looked fabulous. I mean, if you look online, folks, you can see it on YouTube. It is amazing. You look fabulous. You still look fabulous. Oh, yes, you do. Oh, I got to tell you, you do. You absolutely do.
I really had to suck it up. To be so, I was so nervous about wearing that costume.
Oh, you looked great. You really did. You looked fantastic.
Well, it was for a good cause.
Well, I Dream of Jeannie can be seen multiple times a day on Antenna TV, and I Dream of Jeannie, the complete series, is available on DVD. And for more on Barbara, and she's got a great website too, visit BarbaraEden.com. Barbara, what a great thrill it has been to have you hang out with us early this morning. Always a pleasure hanging
thank
out with you. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. So nice. It's fun talking to you.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. The pleasure is all mine.